What we're going to do tonight is he's going to go for about an hour and a half or so, and then stop. And then after that, if you want to go home, you can. If you want to stay, he'll answer questions. So it's whatever you want to do. And there's no extra points for staying. You're not more spiritual or anything like that. So anyway, it's I look forward to this. This is a great time for myself. I really thoroughly enjoy this, and it's a lot of fun. We had fun this afternoon at lunch and just talking and reminiscing a little bit, so it's been good. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll get started. Heavenly Father, again, we pray that you'll guide and direct our thoughts. We pray that you'll help us to have clarity as both Dr. Bookman speaks to us and as we listen. Help us to understand the scriptures and help us to fall in love with the Old Testament, and to understand how basic it is to our understanding of all the scripture. And bless our time this evening in Christ's name. Amen.
Well, good evening. Listen, Pastor mentioned that there are a couple of CDs out there. Now, when I was here some years ago at Spencerport, I did a series on the Passion Week of Jesus. You know, I've often remarked that in God's sweet providences, he just directed my thoughts and my really career, my teaching ministry as through the years, to two areas that are really remarkably overlooked by everybody else in the world. Now, the Old Testament is not entirely overlooked, and it's well attended to here at Spencerport Bible, and I'm appreciative of that. But and that is the life of Jesus, and then just understanding the Old Testament. But at any rate, those CDs, what they are, let me just explain it to you, is one of them is on the Passion Week of, well, one of them is on the life of Jesus. And again, it's not what we're dealing with in this session, but I did do it here some years ago. And it's about 30 hours of lecture, all me, by the way. But it's audio, it's entirely audio. It's MP3. Does everybody understand that? So you can't, some of the newer cars have a CD player you can pop it in, but most of them, it's played on a computer, and then you can put it on an iPod or whatever you have and that sort of thing. So it's just understand, it's MP3. If I did it digitally, it'd take about 30 CDs, you know, and this way it can all go on one. There's also a full set of notes. Now, I didn't finish the thought. On that one, and it's called When God Wore Sandals. Look, there are two of them. They both look exactly alike. This is such a mom and pop thing, my wife and me. So if I'd have had any sense at all, I'd have made them different. But the titles are different at least. But notice that one says When God Wore Sandals, and it's the life of Jesus. And it is, first of all, 15 lectures on the whole life of Jesus. And then there's another series on that same CD of just the Passion Week. And it's about 12 hours. And I did it up in Canada some years ago and had a whole week to give to it, and so we recorded that. And there's also a full set of notes. I mentioned that, a full set of written notes, which you can download, and that might be helpful. The other is called An Introduction to the Pentateuch. It's some of the same stuff that I'm doing here. It's this series and so on. And then going through each of the five books of Moses and so on. And again, an attempt to just make people comfortable with the Old Testament. And I ask if you're able to, for $20, you can either drop it in a basket there, that's fine, or hand it to me. Or, now I mean this from the bottom of my heart, and if it sounds like I'm just working too hard at being noble, I that's not my point at all. If the $20 is a difficulty for you and you could use it, you would use it, just take one. Or leave whatever you can. And nobody's asking any questions. I am the kind of the two twin passions of my life is to help people understand the life of Jesus. It is so important and so overlooked today, and to help people fall in love with the Old Testament. And if those would be helpful to you in that regard, why, I want you to do it. Well, one other thing. Here you went to church and an infomercial broke out. It won't be long. One other thing is, I, for several years, traveled and ministered with a ministry called Friends of Israel. And many of you are familiar with that. Who was telling me this morning, they read time, you mentioned that you want to give a pitch for Israel My Glory, the magazine? Or well, we'll give it to you free for a year. How's that? So the thing about it is, honest to goodness, Friends of Israel, I love the ministry. I'm thrilled to be a part of it in a small way. It is a, we have a magazine, it's called Israel My Glory. I always like to say it's a lay-level, serious Bible study magazine. It's nothing that you're not going to be able to handle, but on the same, by the same token, it's a serious Bible study magazine. And it comes out every third month, comes out four times a year, and there's a clipboard, a yellow clipboard out there. If you put your name on that and so I, an address so I can read it, you know, we will be happy to send you that for a year. And then you'll get a thing asking if you'd like to subscribe. I don't even know how much it costs. But we'd love to have you do it. It's just way out. Now, I got to say this. I am such a local church freak, and I wouldn't want to be part of a ministry that wasn't sensitive to that. And Friends of Israel, it entirely embraces the local church. It'll never come between you and your church. That's not the point at all. And nothing will ever be done with that name other than just sending you the magazine for years. So that'll be laying there, and if you'd like to sign up, you're sure welcome to. All right, let's get to business. Now, I mentioned this morning that I think most of you were here, that we there are these seven definable concepts, which I think taken together help us understand what God is doing in the Old Testament. And we looked at two of those. First of all, let me just rehearse real quickly the intent and importance of Israel's influence, by which I mean that the Bible is so clear that in choosing Israel, God was not neglecting or rejecting or abandoning the rest of the world. That in fact, Israel was intended to be a gracious and careful means by which God, you know, like, I'll finish a thought here, by which God would put himself on display to the world. It was God's grand object lesson. I remember a silly story about a woman who sends her little Johnny off to kindergarten, you know, and he's really a, you know, acts up terribly, you know, and so she sends a note and says, Johnny may give you some grief. We found it doesn't help a lot to physically punish him, but I think it might be good if he's acting up to give the kid next to him a good slap. Well, Israel's kind of been the kid next to us. You know what I'm saying? God has just, no matter what, God made covenant with that nation in order to put himself on display. That covenant was basically, can be most basically subsumed or expressed by Deuteronomy 11, 26 to 28, which says, "Behold, I set before you a blessing and a curse, a blessing if you obey and a curse if you disobey." And when they would obey, think how quickly God marvelously and supernaturally comes to their aid and blesses them and so on. Don't you suppose the rest of the world noticed that? And on the other hand, when they disobeyed, how quickly God punished and how certain it was. Now, you know, mankind has always been anxious to craft a God of his own making, a God who conformed to what he wanted. And we'd rather have a God who was just a grandfather in the sky, that old thing, you know. You know, Paul says, and I think with this in mind in Romans 11, in regard to God's dealing with Israel, remember what he says, "Behold the goodness and severity of God." And you know, God has created us in order that we might know him aright and enjoy him forever. And we need to understand that this God who loves so desperately is a holy God who will not tolerate sin. See where I'm taking you? And so behold both the goodness and the severity of God. And Israel has been throughout human history, and I believe in many ways remains today, though she has been set aside, and though, as I'll say later on this evening, the local church has been called to be the salt and light that Israel once was in this age. But nonetheless, even to this day, Israel continues to be a testimony to the goodness and severity of God. All right, leave that alone. So the intent and importance of Israel's influence is that God raises her up with the intent that they would be, that she as a people. You know, well, let me say one other thing here too. This is really distinct. This isn't so much what I'm talking about, but it's distinct in terms of this is very, very different from what is happening today. You need to understand that the role God intended Israel as a people and as a family and as a clan. In other words, Abraham to Moses, and then Moses until throughout the Old Testament. The purpose for which God, the role that God intended Israel as a family and as a nation to play, she played regardless of how many individual Israelites were actually believing. You see the point? It's at this level that she as a nation was God's object lesson. Now we have no parallel to that. There's no people in our day. I mean, Israel still plays that role, but the way history has unfolded since she was set aside in the times the Gentiles came upon her and Jesus came and the church was born and the gospel goes to the nations and so on, it's very foreign to us. But understand that, see, we think in terms of the church. And the church, of course, is a body of twice-born individuals who are spirit-filled and so on. And so we think, we try and extrapolate that back in the Old Testament. Don't do that. The fact is, God raised up Israel, and she is going to play the role that God intended, regardless of how many individuals are actual twice-born believing children of God. You see my point? All right, I get lost in it. Secondly, the second thing we talked about this morning, and I kind of hurried by it, but this thing, the principle of providential placement. And what I'm talking about here is the way God shaped the face of the earth. And it can't be overstated that in fact, throughout much of history, Israel was the only narrow spot. Well, she still is the only narrow spot in the international highway, but the international highway is not quite so important as it was throughout much of human history. But certainly, throughout the ages of the Old Testament, the fact that Israel was that terribly narrow spot. And I'm going to tell you something. This ramifies in so many different ways in terms of history and the Bible and so on. That is Israel's position there, that one narrow spot on the international highway called the Fertile Crescent. But for our purposes, what I'm trying to draw from it is that, or I want you to see, is that by means of that providential geographical topographical reality, the stories of God's dealings in that place with his people were carried to the uttermost parts of the earth. And we know it's historically undeniable that is the case. That makes sense to you? Let me just interrupt myself here. One of the most, I cherish the doctrine of God's providence. Now, here's a little quiz for you. We're being a little informal. I would say that it's fair. I think it is theologically, biblically accurate to say that all of God's dealings with mankind, all of them throughout history, can be categorized under one of two categories, can be subsumed or under one of two rubrics. In other words, these are mutually exhaustive and mutually exclusive. The one is providence. God, most of the time, works through providence. What's the other category? If he's not working providentially, what's the other category? Can you tell me? No, let me say it this way. When he works providentially, we call that God working mediately. In other words, through means. When he works in the other way, he works immediately. There are no means. What do we call it? You know where I'm taking you? Miracle. Now, that's all there is. Either God works miraculously or God works providentially. Miraculously is immediate. There is no secondary causation, so waters are parted, Israel walks through. You have a grand illustration of this in the Old Testament, where God two different times delivers Israel from a Gentile overlord. The first time he delivers Israel from Egypt, that is punctuated with miracle, right? The plagues, the Red Sea, the bread falling out of heaven, all of that's miracle. The second time God delivers Israel from Babylon. You ever thought about this? No miracles. I always think it would have been tough if you were having your devotions out of Exodus on the way, you're one of those people coming back from Babylon, you're reading, man, back then bread was falling out of heaven. We got to go find our own bread, We get thirsty, we got no water coming out of the rock, But in fact, God, I think the lesson is God knows how to deliver his people either miraculously, immediately, and in that case, there's absolutely no denying that God's in it, or providentially, immediately, And in that case, it takes the eye of faith to believe that God's behind it. Because the world is going to assume that that's just some sort of grand accident, right? And Bible believers ought to know and cherish the reality that God knows how to work providentially. We have that kind of God. Now, having said that, my point is simply this, that there is no greater evidence of God's providence, his providential control of human history, his providential, I don't want to say control, because I don't mean to say that we're all puppets and so on, but his providential ordering of human history than the survival of the people of Israel. And in that regard, you want to read a fascinating book. Here I am, you know, the Bookman Book Club is in session here just momentarily, but you want to read a fascinating book. There's a book called The Bible and the Sword. It's a woman by a woman named Barbara Tuchman, T-U-C-H-M-A-N, Barbara Tuchman. And Barbara Tuchman was one of the most important military historians of our age. Maybe you have heard of her kind of, her very, very important book on the First World War called The Guns of August, which is sort of the definitive definition of, explanation of how the First World War gets started. Barbara Tuchman was very, very Jewish. She taught at the University of Chicago all of her life. Very Jewish. She had a distant ancestor who had actually been very much a part of the Balfour Declaration. Her book, The Bible and the Sword, is a history of the Balfour Declaration and how it came. Now, the Balfour Declaration, if you don't know, that was in after the First World War. Lord Balfour, who was very briefly the Prime Minister of Great Britain before he was Prime Minister, when he had a different office in the Foreign Office, got the Queen to sign a declaration that simply said that Her Majesty's government looks with favor upon the reestablishment of a home for Israel in her ancient land, something like that. And it was entirely meaningless in terms of political clout. It just was Her Majesty's government looks with favor upon this idea. After the First World War, as the dust was settling, and the victorious nations didn't know what to do with that little strip of land over there, they turned it over to Great Britain in what's called the British Mandate. They mandated Britain to handle that little strip of land, and they took that Balfour Declaration and included it as part of the mandate, and that gave it the force of international law. And the reason there is a state of Israel today, I mean, politically and historically, is because of the Balfour Declaration. And she traces the events that led up to the Balfour Declaration. It's a fascinating read, fascinating read. And what she does, and I got to tell you this, and with this I'll quit here, I'll quit talking about this. But what she does, she traces all of these events. One of the most important was the great evangelical revival in Great Britain of the 1800s. And she acknowledges it was because of men who loved the scriptures and therefore loved Israel. And she resents this deeply because she's very Jewish and she doesn't appreciate the evangelical world, but she has to acknowledge again and again that it was largely, in many ways, it was because of that. But she appeals to all of these remarkable incidents which happened. But here's the point she makes. She says, we stand at this point in history, we look back, and we see how because this happened, this was able to happen. Because this happened, this was able to happen. But she says, what you need to understand is that if you were living through these things, as each of those events happened, it didn't make the likelihood of a state of Israel greater. It made it more and more impossible. And as you got closer, it was more and more unthinkable that there would ever be a state of Israel. And yet, there she is. Herman Wouk. Oh, forgive me. I think Herman Wouk, who is my all-time favorite author, but Herman Wouk in his book, The Will to Live On, he says he's talking about the birth of the state of Israel, and he says for 150 years, the Jewish people fought and quarreled and struggled and walked out on each other and grew more and more angry with each other. But through the whole 150 years, there were two non-negotiables. There has to be a state of Israel in the ancient land, and when we get there, we have to speak Hebrew. That's the only thing they could agree on. Today, the Jewish people are fighting and scrapping and quarreling and walking out in each other, but they're doing it in Israel, and they're doing it in Hebrew. It's really remarkable what God has wrought, I'm telling you. Now, what am I talking about that? The point is simply this. Come way back to this. I'm talking about the principle of providential placement, and it is intriguing to me to see how that God has contrived to keep that little tiny land at the very center of human history in every age. And throughout much of the history, and certainly out throughout the period of history that we're contemplating, and that is the Old Testament era, throughout that era, the primary means by which that was accomplished was that, in fact, she was the only narrow spot on the ancient highway. Does that make sense to you? All right, now a third. Now remember where we started out, by the way, that I took you to that verse in Exodus 19 where God said that I am going to make of you a kingdom with a priestly function and a holy nation. And so in order for them to be that kingdom with a priestly function, they had to be a set-apart nation. Now that relates to this third one, and I call it the dynamics of distinctive divisions. How many of you have been to Israel? Any of you? I can't see anybody. Shame on you. Find a way to get to Israel. I always tell people there's no bad way to go to Israel, but some are better than others. And so find a way to go to Israel. By the way, you young people, you want to go to Israel, talk to me. You got 6 months of your life, you want to get to Israel, I can get you there. But all right, but how's that for a, come on. Here's my point. When you go to Israel, everybody who goes, again and again, when I go with people, they remark on the fact that the land is so tiny. So tiny. Like I say, about 120 miles north to south, 40 miles east to west in the north, and as the Mediterranean Sea kind of cuts away, 80 miles east to west in the south. Smaller than the state of Rhode Island. It's just a teeny, teeny little land. But in spite of the fact that it is so tiny, it is marked by these remarkable divisions. And there are these five east to west divisions. Now, we're going to do a little more geography and topography here, so hold on. I'm going to do it quickly. There's a map. If you have the notes, I give you a map similar to this, although it's not in color and it's a little hard to see. But at any rate, the point is this. You have these in that little land, you have these divisions. First of all, and I'm going to walk through these real quickly and then make a point. First of all, there is the area known as the coastal plains, and it's very, very self-explanatory, but along the Mediterranean Sea, those coastal plains are quite flat, quite open. When a geographer talks about a land that's open, it means simply you can put a road most anywhere. It's not hard to plot a road. When you talk about a land that's closed, whether you got mountains or lakes or whatever, it's the roads have to follow very, you know, well-defined terrain. And so the coastal plain is relatively open. Let me say this. I feel like I got a little time here. This coastal plain, this area, and by the way, the Valley of Jezreel. Remember I talked about this morning that sort of arrowhead-shaped valley? No, I didn't, did I? That was somewhere else. I just mentioned the Valley of Jezreel. Well, it's right there, and then the Plain of Akko to the north. This right here is where that international highway called the Way of the Sea, the Via Maris, travels and so on. It's kind of interesting that to the north, the area is not so open. And to the south, it's quite open. The area to the south, by the way, is what's called Philistia, the area where, as we get into the book of Samuel and so on, you have the Philistines. Now, here are some pictures, and again, these are rather self-explanatory, but that's looking out across toward the Mediterranean Sea, looking toward the west, looking at the Philistine plain, standing at Gath, one of the five cities of the Philistine Pentapolis. That's the valley, that's looking down at the Valley of Jezreel. We're on Mount Carmel. This is the broad valley right here. There is Mount Tabor. That's the hill of Moreh. There's the hill of Gilboa. So that, like I say, is an interior plain, but it's an extension of the coastal plain. So you get the idea. Now, inland from the coastal plains is an area called the Shvelah. The Shvelah, what do you care? But the Shvelah is an area. Shvelah means lowland or Piedmont, foothills. And again, it's quite open and rolling. I'll show you here just quickly. Here are pictures of the, this is one of the passes coming up through the Shvelah. Here, by the way, see this? This, all right, the next region I'm going to introduce you to is the hill country. And it goes up very quickly. Those are the Judean hills. But this down here is this open area, a little more rolling and so on. This is the Guvrim Valley and so on. So the Shvelah, as you see there. Now, let me just tell you something. Two things about the Shvelah. And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you something else. I don't know why. But when you are reading the scriptures and you come to Hebrew names, I can tell you how to sound like you know something. And I've made a career of sounding like I know more than I do. So just know you're talking to an expert here. But I've had people say, you must know Hebrew. You speak modern. I know very little Hebrew. I should know more than I do. In Hebrew, the accent is always on the last syllable. You can make yourself sound really bright just by working at that. The accent is always on the last syllable. So it's not Isaac, it's Yitzhak. It's not Jerusalem, it's Yerushalayim. You know what I'm saying? It's Israel. So it's Shvelah. You can actually sound like you know. So I'll tell you one other thing. There are no functional diphthongs. Every vowel, you're going to have to say every vowel out loud. So you're going to have to, you know, that's why when we say Israel, it just sounds for all the world that it should be R-E-A-L, doesn't it? You always got to remind ourselves. No, but it's Ra-A-L. A-L is what. Now, when you get done saying it, it comes out like a, but there are functional diphthongs, but there are no formal diphthongs, you know, where two vowels compress to one sound. What in the world? But anyway, the Shvelah is hugely important. And this will help you with a lot of things in Old Testament. I'm wandering here, but I got a map in front of me, and I get distracted. In fact, most of Israel's enemies come from the east. Their enemies almost always come from the east, but they will often be described as a king out of the north. And the reason is because of the Fertile Crescent. They're going to have to follow the crescent, so they're going to come down from the north. Now, Israel's capital is Jerusalem. And if they are going to take Jerusalem and possess it, if they just want to control the passes, I mean the international highway, they don't need Jerusalem. But if they want to control the land and put it under tribute, such as Babylon is going to do and Assyria tries to do, but 185,000 guys wake up dead, remember that story? The fact is that they're going to have to take Jerusalem, which is right here in the hills. And the only way, for reasons I shouldn't take the time to explain, but Jerusalem is in the hill country. That hill country is very closed, very narrow. We'll talk about it in just a minute. I'll show you some pictures. So if you're going to attack Jerusalem, you're going to have to do it from the west. And the armies will always make their way down that highway that we saw before, through the pass of the Megiddo Pass, come down here, and now there are four passes. And they're really passes through the Shvelah that open up to a ridge. And when they say a ridge, you're talking about a very steep ridge, but it's a ridge that goes all the way up. And that's the road you have to follow. And there are only four of them. So the way to garrison Jerusalem is to garrison the Shvelah. Does that make sense to you? The Shvelah is always in the Bible the buffer zone. If you're going to attack Jerusalem, you have to do it from the west. And as you come from the west, if it was you, like I say, and your two buddies, you could do it any way you wanted. But if you're moving an army, you're going to have to follow the international highway. Once you follow that highway, you're going to get down there on the Via Maris to the west of Jerusalem. And now you're going to attack up into the hills, and you've got to take one of those four, the Lachish Pass, the Ela Valley, now that doesn't come to me, but there are four passes, and each one of them is guarded by a city, Beit Shemesh. Remember when Solomon garrisons the fortress cities? One of them is Beit Shemesh that guards the Sorek approach, the Sorek Valley. Couldn't say it for a minute. All right. Well, at any rate, having said it, you have the coastal plains, then the Shvelah. Now, one other thing. The Shvelah only exists in the south. The hill country is only down here to the south. Up here in the north, I'm sorry. The Shvelah is only to the south. To the north, you have hill country, but the hills come steeply right down to the coast. For that reason, it didn't drain very well. The Shvelah absorbed a lot of the water. Israel gets plenty of water, but it's on this very steep terrain that it runs off very, very quickly. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And to the south, the Shvelah absorbed much of that water. To the north, because it comes down so steeply, it produced a swamp. And it was interesting that in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, when the Jewish people were fleeing other parts of the world and were coming back, and a lot of philanthropists were buying land and so on, the land that the Arabs were willing to sell them was often up here in the north. And the reason was because it was underwater, literally. It was alligator swamps, literally. And they would come here and find that their land was totally unusable. The reason was because, number one, there's no Shvelah here to absorb the water as it comes down out of the hills. The other thing was that there was a unique sea creature, or a creature, there's a sea creature that rather uniquely bonded, I don't understand much about it, but it bonded the sand in such a way that it didn't drain well. And so those Jewish people, when they came back and found this virtually unusable land, they did two things. Number one, they dynamited that, it's called Karkar, Q-A-R-Q-A-R, but that deposit that so dammed up the water that it couldn't escape, and they dynamited it and, you know, dug drainage ditches to get the water to drain off the land. And then the other thing is they planted eucalyptus trees, which suck water out of the earth. Now, today, they'd like to be rid of many of those eucalyptus trees because, you know, they really struggle with water. And eucalyptus trees are doing the same thing. They're all over. They're not indigenous to the land. But today, that's some of the most fertile land in all the world. And they have reclaimed that land, and they grow largely flowers there. They ship tulips to Holland. And used to be, I don't know what it is today because they've gotten so much into electronics and so on, but it used to be that flowers were their number three business in Israel. Mostly, by the way, you remember what that's called in the Old Testament? That's the Plain of Sharon. And what do you remember in the Bible? Remember the Rose of Sharon? And it's perfect climate for growing beautiful flowers, and they were able to reclaim it. Well, that's extra. All right, so I got to hurry. Beyond the Shvelah, so you have the coastal plain, then the Shvelah. Now here's the big one, is what's called the Central Hill Country. Now this is, in fact, a spine of very steep, and it's really remarkable when you go to Israel. If you go, first of all, to Jerusalem, you leave the airport, you drive through the northern Shvelah, and all of a sudden you're just driving along kind of low hills, very, very gentle hills, and all of a sudden, broop, up you go. You just, the hill country just thrusts out of, and it's, again, this is a teeny land, but these divisions are so remarkably distinct. And the Central Hill Country spreads all throughout, from north to south. It's interrupted by the Valley of Jezreel, but it's flatter, more plateaus up here in Galilee, but even there, it's very, very steep hills. Now, and very inaccessible, very hard to get up there. And when you get up there, you just got to come back down. Now, here are some pictures. This is these rocky Judean. And again, we're not talking beautiful. I mean, it has its own charm, but it's not beautiful terrain. We're not talking high mountains and so on. It's just very, very steep. And notice the ridges, not what are called the terraces. See them here? You can see them. I think we'll see them better on, you can just see these terraces right here. See, the land of Israel, especially in Judea, there is some basalt deposit, which is a hard, you know, volcanic rock, but most of Israel is made of limestone, which is a sedimentary rock, you know, that was laid down after the flood. And as it was thrust up, it produced these natural terraces. Now, two things real quickly. Those terraces make it very hard. You can't just wander over hill and dale, you see, because you're not just walking down a hillside. You're walking out 6 feet and dropping down two and walking down, you know what I'm saying? It's a terrace. So again, if you're moving an army or a caravan, you simply have to stay up on the ridge. We're talking, you know what, I should say something. When you're talking, you need to distinguish between what we call international routes and internal routes. Now, the distinction is rather obvious. But international routes go from country to country. Internal routes go from village to village. And what we're talking about here is internal routes. There is no international route that's going to go through the hill country. It's going to avoid it like the plague because you don't want to get up there. And you're endangering yourself if you do get up there because it's so narrow. And so you're going to stay down on the plain. But internally, you have these hills. Now, so the point is that not only are they very steep, but by reason of the way the geology and the way it's formed, it becomes impossible to travel except on the ridges. You have to follow the ridge route. The primary north-south route through Israel is called the ridge route, and it follows it wanders back and forth because you can imagine these, but it's a continuous thing in the ridge, and it's called the way of the patriarchs because it's precisely the way Abraham followed when he came from Ur of the Chaldees. It is precisely the way that David followed when he attacked the city of Jerusalem. It is precisely the way the armies of Israel traveled when they were attacking Jerusalem in 1967. If you're going to move north and south, and it's precisely the way that you will go if you get in a bus and head north from Jerusalem, you will follow that route. You have to. There's no other north-south internal route. Does that make sense to you? So it's here's another thing real quickly. These terraces. There. You can see the terraces there. See here, these terraces low on the hill? The Jewish people became very adept, very, very expert at farming these terraces. And I'm going to say to you in a minute, we're going to talk about the distinction between the winter crops and the summer crops. The summer crops are the hillside crops. But you see the picture there, just file it away. You see, you have these natural terraces. And what the Jewish people would do, and they did in other parts of the world as well, is they would enhance those terraces. They would build out at the edge of the terrace where it drops off, they would build a rock wall. And then they would wait some years for the rains to come and wash soil down behind that rock wall. And then they would spend a lot of time digging out the rocks. There's a legend that the Israelis tell, that the Jewish people tell, that when God created the earth, he got all done, everything was in place except for a big bag of rocks he intended to be spread over the entire earth, and the angels just got started and the bag broke. And they'll be working, you know, over Israel, and they'll be working, they'll say, well, what do you think? The bag broke, you know, because you'll see a plowed field with these, you know, good-sized rocks just floating everywhere. But anyway, so they would dig out the rocks and they would plant a vine and they would, so the point is that on those hillsides, they would grow grapes and figs and olives, primarily. Does that make sense to you? Those are the hillside crops. Just remember, by the way, just real quickly here, take your Bible and go to Isaiah 5 and see how this fits. You know, God often represented Israel as a vineyard, and Israel kind of picked up on that. They kind of loved it, even though the picture here is not a happy picture. But if you look at Isaiah 5 in this remarkable song of the vineyard, it says in Isaiah 5, verse 1, now, let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. Well, picture that. It's on the screen. When you picture that, that's a kind of, on the side of the hill, on those terraces is where they would. And it goes on to say, he dug it up, he cleared out its stones. So that's exactly what you do. You plow it, you clear out the stones, and he planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst. Now, one other thing, normally your hillside crops were not close to your home. They would be out in the edge of the village somewhere. And because when the grapes started to come, especially the grapes, though the olives were also a consideration, olives grown on the olive tree, grapes grown on, of course, on the ground. But when they came, both the little foxes and thieves, you had to be concerned. So you'd build a tower, and these towers are still all over Israel. As you're driving around, you'll look and say, hey, see, there's an ancient vineyard tower. And when the fruit came, one of the boys from the village would sleep, or a couple of the boys would sleep in that vineyard. In that tower, and they would watch. They would take turns watching to make sure that the animals didn't come, and so on. So the point is, when he says there in verse 2 that he built a tower in its midst, he fully expected fruit. That's why he built the tower, because he knew he was going to have to. But then it says, So he expected to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And then he goes on to say, now you judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard? And of course, Israel is that vineyard. But that picture of a fruitful hill and a vineyard, that's where vineyards always grew and so on, is right there. Well, so the Central Hill Country. Now, beyond the Central Hill Country, the fourth, we said there are five divisions, and the fourth division is what's called the Jordan Rift. I made reference to this morning, I think, but the Jordan Rift is the deepest fault line on the face of the earth. It's a cleft in the face of the earth. It totally defines the geography and the climate of Israel, this huge fault in the face of the earth. And it extends from the north, way up between the Lebanon and Anna-Lebanon Mountains, up here in Lebanon, through the Hula Valley. This Hula Valley is north of the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level on its surface. Well, how low is Death Valley? That's the lowest place in America. Anybody know how low that is? It's not. I don't think it's 600 feet. I don't think it's that low. This is really a remarkable. Now, from the Sea of Galilee, you have the Jordan River making its way all the way through the rift. I mentioned earlier that remember this morning I talked about how the two cradles of civilization were defined by rivers. And some have asked, well, why didn't the Jordan? The Jordan was never navigable. Today, it's a little tiny farm creek. I mean, it just meanders back and forth, and there are places where you can almost jump across it. But the reason is because modern Israel, her greatest source of water, about 60% of her water comes from the Sea of Galilee, and they suck so much water out of there that the Jordan River has become just a little creek. In the ancient world, at flood season, it was a raging torrent. And remember, it was at flood season that Joshua crossed the Jordan River. Remember that, where the waters were parted? The rest of the year, it meanders back and forth. It actually covers about 200 miles. It's 60 miles from here, from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. But as it makes its way back and forth, it covers about 200 miles. But it's just a meandering creek today. But then it comes down. Jericho sits right north of the Dead Sea. Jericho is the lowest city on the face of the earth because the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level on its surface, and it's 1,200 feet deep. So this is a huge cleft. And you can imagine as the winds come in and they, you know, as they're forced up, you get all this dumping of water, and then as it falls down, you get the horribly dry. By the way, right here along the Dead Sea. Now remember, the Dead Sea is dead because water gets out only by evaporation. Understand that you got the water flowing in, no outlet. I think I said this morning, I think that traces to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Personally, I'm mildly convinced. I believe this with two or three fibers of my being, if you know what I'm saying. You can talk me out of this, but my persuasion is that there used to be an open water flow here. And that's why, for instance, when Abraham came to this region with Lot and they looked across the well-watered plains, you look across this today and it's anything but a well-watered plain. But I think it was dammed up with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so this sea has become more and more dead. And the reason is because water gets out only by evaporation. As it does, it leaves behind the mineral content and primarily the salt. And so the saline content gets so high, it's about 20%, whereas normally it's about 3% salt water. That's why when you go to Israel, you see them, you know, laying in the Dead Sea, reading the magazine, all that sort of thing. You float, you bob like a cork. And the reason is that that's why it's the Dead Sea. Now, the point is, to the west of the Dead Sea, right along here, here's the hill country, and the area between the Dead Sea and the hill country right here is called the wilderness. In the Hebrew, it's the Jeshimon. And it's a function of the fact that for 6 months, as I'll say later on, remember, over here is the Arabian Desert. And for 6 months of the year, all the weather comes from the east, off the Arabian Desert. So you get these hot, dry desert winds blowing across this sea, which is, you know, just has this remarkable saline content. The sulfur smell just permeates the place, and it just bakes this part of the world. It's a little strip of land which is like a moonscape. Now, that becomes hugely important. because this area, this little strip of land, which is so close to Jerusalem, and so you can get there within a couple of hours walking, but it is like no other place on the face of the earth, and it becomes a place where if you are a fugitive, you will flee. Remember when David is fleeing from Saul? He spends much of his time here in the Jeshimon, and he knows it well. By the way, I'm getting lost in this, but even though it's horribly barren, there is a little scrub that grows up every year, and shepherds will go down there with their sheep and the goats. You always see them when you're driving through the Jeshimon today, and the hills are all laced with goat tracks. And you'll see, if you're there in the spring of the year especially, you'll see the little scrub that's good for the goats and so on. And so David was a shepherd boy. He knew this area well. One of the things that's really a delight to do is to go to the Jeshimon, to the wilderness, and spend a little time reading some of the Psalms that quite clearly arose out of that experience when David was fleeing from Saul. But not only fugitives, but also if you just wanted to get alone, if you wanted to be entirely alone, this is where Jesus goes to be tempted of the devil for 40 days. Now, I always, for some reason, in my mind's eye, when I hear about Jesus in the wilderness, I think of a jungle, you know what I'm saying, with the big banana trees and everything. And the fact is that it's this moonscape. It's unlike almost any place in the face of the earth. But you can be entirely alone. People, it's very impassable. Now, another group that found seclusion here, we think, there's some debate, but almost certainly, was a group called the Essenes. They lived here during the time of Jesus because they were offended by the temple and so on. So they moved out here and started a complex, the Essene complex. And how do we remember them? Do you know what I'm talking about? This is the group that produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so that, you know, hugely important body of intertestamental literature called the Dead Sea Scrolls arose here in the Jeshimon. They were found there. That's where the Dead Sea Caves are found. So at any rate, that area right there, the Jeshimon, is part of the Jordan Rift. Now, let me show you just a couple of pictures. That's not the Jordan Rift, but this, you get a picture. This is really kind of fascinating, but it's something entirely different. This is what's called the Nahal Kidron. You know, when we moved to California, we were moving. I lived in Minnesota, Illinois, Minnesota, and then Dallas for a while. And I noticed on a map of the city to which we were moving, there was a river, went right through the middle of town. I thought, well, won't that be pleasant? You know, there's probably a river walk maybe, you know, and little boats and so on. I think two times in my whole life I saw water in that river. The rest of the time it was just this dry, ugly wash, right? And when the rains had come, it just flow, you know, that's exactly the same here. And a dry riverbed, or a riverbed which is dry most of the year, is called a Nahal, that's Hebrew, or a Wadi. Have you heard that word? That's Aramaic, or Arabic, I'm sorry. So the Nahal Kidron is hugely important because the Kidron is a valley between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives. And the temple was a slaughterhouse. And throughout the year, and then especially at Passover when you had the slaying of thousands and thousands of lambs, all of that had to be disposed of somehow. Now, much of it was scooped up and burned and buried and so on. But the blood was all washed away into the Nahal Kidron, and the really nifty thing is that God crafted the earth so this Nahal Kidron makes its way all the way down to the Dead Sea. And so all of that was flushed into the Dead Sea with that high saline content that just emulsified it, you know, and destroyed it. It's really a remarkably effective providential sewage system. But you get a feel for the here again, that's Masada on the distance, that's the Dead Sea and the beyond Masada, but this is the wilderness, the Jeshimon. Here's another picture as the sun goes down in the Judean wilderness. That's the northern tip of the Dead Sea just beyond. But again, the point is, I've shown you the wilderness, but this rift in the earth defines everything. Well, I got to be done. What's this got to do? I like to talk about Israel way too much. Beyond is the Transjordanian Plateau. That doesn't apply too much to what we're saying, but here's my point. All right, so I'm actually going to get back to our lecture. And I'm saying that, number one, God intended for Israel to be salt and light. That was always God's purpose. Number two, to that end, he crafted the world, the face of the earth, in such a way that Israel was the only narrow spot on the international highway, and so everybody was funneled through there, and as they did so, they came to, they heard the stories of this remarkable God who actually interacted on behalf of his people, and those stories were carried to the end of the earth. But number three, and I'm calling it here the dynamic of distinctive divisions, God shaped that little tiny strip of land in such a way that even though you have this international highway, what's the big interstate going through here? We're on the 90. Okay. Well, I always say it's like living on the median of the I-90. You know what I'm saying? You got all this traffic, this international highway, but they're living in between it. But this little strip of land is where Jerusalem is. And thus, and all of those armies and caravans that are so anxious to pass through this land are not at all interested in making their way up. So my point is, remember, in order for them to be a kingdom with a priestly function, it was an imperative that they be a set-apart nation. And God told them to stay in the land and to honor him. And when they were at their weakest, they were still in control of that hill country. And so you see where I'm taking you? God shaped the earth in such a way that the armies and caravans of the world be making their way through there. But then he shaped the land in such a way that regardless of how much traffic there was on the international trunk highways, they could live in remarkable isolation. Everybody who studies Israel, geographers, always make the comment that it is a land which is at once so private and so public. You can have that hill country entirely to yourself. When you stand in that hill country, when you stand, for instance, at Yad HaShmoneh, which is a place I often, just outside of the city of Jerusalem, where I often stay, as the sun goes down, you can see the lights of Tel Aviv on the coast. It's that close. You can look out there and see where the international highway is. But you can have that hill country entirely to yourself. That makes sense to you? In the ancient world. So God's intent is that Israel would be salt and light. In order to make that happen, he caused all the nations of the world to be passing constantly through that land. But he shaped the land in such a way that they could live with remarkable security and privacy up there in the hill country and honor and worship God in the tabernacle temple unto themselves. And that's exactly what God intended. Does that make sense to you? All right. All right, let me take you to a fourth. Now I got to hurry, and I can get lost in any one of these. But again, remember, I'm going to try and tie this all together. And the fourth concept I call the wisdom and will of God concerning the worship and the walk of Israel. Folks, what I'm talking about here is the Torah. Now, that is the law. Now, let me stop on that for just a minute. I mentioned to you before that it is really well into Old Testament history before God frames the people of Israel into the nation of Israel. It's Moses. It's 1400 BC. So we've got much of Old Testament history has already gone by. But think about the way the Bible unfolds. In Genesis 1 to 11, you have that period of universal dealings before Abraham is even chosen. And as I said, you got at least 2,000 years of history almost right there. Then in Genesis 12 through 50, in the balance of the book of Genesis, you have the story of the four patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And when you close the pages of Genesis, Jacob has taken his clan of 70 down into Egypt. When you open the pages of Exodus, 400 years have gone by. And remember when, by the way, I go back, when you close the pages of Genesis, they have gone down into Egypt and they're well received. They're loved by the Egyptians. When you open the book of Exodus, years have gone by. They have become a king who knew not Joseph has arisen, and they have become a slave people. And now God brings them out, gets them to Mount Sinai, forms them into a nation, right? So most of Old Testament history happens in the book of Genesis. Think about this. Moses wrote five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Genesis is history to Moses. Exodus through Deuteronomy is his diary, right? He lived this. He's born in Exodus 2. He dies in Deuteronomy 34. So how much time does Exodus to Deuteronomy cover? If it's Moses' life, how long did Moses live? 120 years. Genesis, everything before it. Now, again, my point is that there's a lot of, most of the history happens before Moses. But we're most familiar with what happens after Moses because we have so much more scripture relating it and so on. It's obviously very important. Let me just make this point. This is so big, and it's related to what I'm going to talk about in just a moment, but it's a little extra. Folks, understand this, that when in the days of Moses, God got Israel, that large now two plus, I mentioned before that there were about over 2 million people whom Moses brought out of Egypt. Do you know how we discern that? How we come by that number? The 600,000 is what? The fighting men. In the book of Numbers, the reason it's called Numbers is because we have two numberings. First of all, the unbelieving and then the believing generation. And in both cases, well, the number, the first numbering is 603,550 men or something like that. So if you've got 603 men who are 20 ages, they're able to go to war. They're at least 20 years of age. They're not so old that they can't go to war, and they're not Levites. And then you figure, well, that's just the fighting men. So if there's every reason to believe them, most of them were married, where then you've got twice that with their wives. And then if you figure they probably had a couple of kids each, probably more than that, but I know we're double counting here, so it becomes very approximate at this point. In other words, some of those sons were also among the fighting men, but the fact is that you've probably got well over 2 million people. So my point is, when God got Israel, the people of Israel, out of Egypt, brought them to Mount Sinai, and made them, by reason of that Mosaic or Sinaitic covenant, made them into the nation of Israel. At that point, God became their king. It is so important to understand that in the Old Testament, Yahweh personally, really, became king over Israel. That's exactly the arrangement. It's what we call the theocracy. Theos, God, kratos, rule. It's the rule by God. Now, that word theocracy has been misused, and you know, the Muslim countries are regarded as a theocracy because there is a religion at the heart of it and so on. That's not really formally what a theocracy is. A theocracy is where God personally rules. And it happened. It happened from 1466 to 592. Now, I can develop that later on, but 1446 is the year where God offered them that covenant. They accepted the covenant. Look, in Exodus, this is what happens. Exodus 19, he gets them out there. I read the verse this morning. If you will obey, you will be my people, and I will be your God. And they accept the covenant, and so the covenant is cut. What's the first thing that happens? God calls Moses up into the mountain, where he is there for 40 days, during which time he neither eats nor drinks. He just subsists on the person of God. And for 40 days, God gives him the instruction as to how to build the tabernacle. Now, then you have the golden calf incident, and then Moses comes up for a second 40 days. So now God gives Moses exactly the directions how to build the tabernacle. Moses goes down and builds the tabernacle, and Exodus chapter 40, after the tabernacle is complete, what happens? The glory cloud, which has heretofore been hovering on the top of Mount Sinai, lifts up and enters the Holy of Holies. That is King Yahweh taking his throne. The tabernacle was a deliberate, unmistakable throne room. And it was made to travel because the people were going to travel. And when it's interesting, we know from the ancient world that when people would march, they would always have the king's quarters at the center, and the tribes were arranged in such a way as to give the greatest protection to the king. It's exactly how God demanded that the Israelites, he gave them the order of march. Remember, as they marched toward Canaan and so on, Yahweh is king in Israel. Not in some spiritual sense, like you ought to be king in your life and he was king over them. No, in that too, but in a most literal, real sense, God was king. Now, let me tell you one other thing. All the time that God is king, he mediates his rules through some human representative. First of all, it's Moses. When Moses dies, he's succeeded by Joshua. When Joshua dies, you have this strange situation. We'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow night. For 350 years, during which local rulers, we call them judges. The grand distinction of that period is that there's no one ruler in Israel. Every man did that which is right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel. So you have local rulers, but they are God's representatives. Now, after the judges, God allows them to have a human king. A lot of people have the notion, so you have, first of all, united monarchy, Saul, David, Solomon, remember? And then, of course, you have the disillusion, the northern kingdom, southern kingdom. Now you have a king in the north, king in the south, until they're finally carried off the southern kingdom to Babylon. Now, my point is, a lot of people have the notion that when God allowed them to have kings, he ceased to be king. That's not true. They were only, even though he allowed them to have kings, those kings were only his the real king was Yahweh. That makes sense to you? That is so big. If you're going to understand what's going on in the Old Testament, you got to come to grips with the real theocracy. And there was a period when there were human kings. Folks, this is just a definitional question, but it becomes important. What makes a monarchy different from every other form? In other words, what distinguishes a king as opposed to, for instance, a Kaiser or a dictator of any sort, you know? You know what it is that when Israel said, make us a king, they were thinking of something very distinct. Not just somebody. See, Moses had all the power he could want, right? Ask Korah, if you know what I'm saying. But was Moses a king? No, you never think of King Moses. What is it that distinguishes kingship? You know where I'm taking you here? It's more than that. You can have lordship and ownership. What is it? The bloodline, which is to say what? When he dies, it's successionism. It's the idea that when the king dies, his son succeeds. That's definitional to a king. Now, there was a point in Israel's history where they demanded a king. They wanted, I won't go into it, it says Samuel is getting old. I talked about it this morning, how he had turned the nation around with his ministry and so on. For 300 years, they'd been under local rulers. It had been horrible. They'd been rejected. They'd been defeated, and it was just the dark age of Old Testament history. Now they've had Samuel, and they say, if you die, Samuel, we won't have any means by which to choose a successor. We'll just fight and squabble among ourselves. So before you die, make us a ruler. And by the way, make it a king, and we'll have this thing done once and for all. Remember that? So that's exactly what they're asking for. Now, God, because all of this is... Look, the Old Testament moves toward David. Once David is here, everything kind of builds on David. The peak is David, because David is the great archetype of Messiah. And so we're moving toward David, toward King David. And so God does, in fact, allow them to have kings. But please, I'm going to say it one more time. In so doing, God was not surrendering the theocracy. And more books, I run into books that talk about when Samuel died and kings were made, that was the transition from the theocracy to the monarchy. No, it was not. It was still a theocracy. But now the human representative, Moses, Joshua, the judges, now the human kings. But the human kings were to understand that they were only... Do you remember Deuteronomy 17 when Moses, way back in the law, anticipated the day when they would have kings, and he made three restrictions? What were they, remember? Number one, don't multiply horses, wives, the big one, silver and gold. Now, here's the thing. In the ancient world, those are the three ways a king aggrandized himself. You want to prove you're a great king? Number one, have a lot of wives. Now, why? Is that just... Now, it's not just what comes immediately to mind. The fact is that if I'm king of this territory and I'm really powerful, princes and feudal lords and local kinglets are going to come to me and ask to make a treaty that I won't attack them, that I'll protect them, and so on, and they'll always seal that treaty with a princess. So if you've got a large harem, you're a powerful king. That's the most important means of establishing your power. Publicly displaying the strength of your kingdom is the size of your harem. Number two, if you're going to be a grand king, you want to have grand armies. And the sophisticated military hardware of that day was the chariot. And if you're going to pull a chariot, you got to have horses. And God said, I'll take care of you. It's not that you shouldn't know warfare, but I don't want you going down to Egypt and getting horses. And number three, of course, you aggrandize yourself with great display of wealth. It's just interesting as you read the story of King Solomon, who started so well. And then you get to 1 Kings 12, and I swear it sounds like he's got a checklist. You know what I'm saying? Remember that? So he got the great harem, got to take care, you know, and then he went out and got so much so you didn't even care about silver. Gold was the only thing. Okay, got to take, now I'm going to go down and get some horses. And he got the... Now, the point is that even though God allowed Israel to have kings, all honor was to go to King Yahweh. And so he very carefully interdicts all of those things which are the standard means by which a king would prove his prowess, would aggrandize himself in the face of the world. So I come way back to it. Here's where I'm taking you with all of this. When God in Exodus 19, made that covenant that we remember as the old covenant, the Sinaitic covenant, the law. He made it in order that he might be the king in Israel. Now, under a monarchy, the arrangement is that the king makes the laws. And it's interesting, I mentioned that in Exodus chapter 40, King Yahweh leaves Mount Sinai, the glory cloud, lifts up and takes his position on the throne. That's where the book of Exodus closes. You go to the book of Leviticus, and what happens? King Yahweh begins to make laws. Leviticus 1:1 says, so Yahweh spoke and Moses wrote it in a book. I got to think Moses had some severe writer's cramp, you know, about halfway through that, but he just, because God is making the law. No, King Yahweh is making the law. Does that make sense to you? Now, here's my point. And I can get so lost in this. We got to keep going, but I'm telling you something. There is an intuitive sense in which believers in this age under the new covenant, believers who have schooled themselves on Galatians and Romans and so on, rejoice over the fact that we are no longer under the law. Amen and amen. There's not a man on earth who is more thrilled to live under the new covenant relationship than I. But my fear and my observation is that in many cases that translates itself into a rather ignoble contempt for the law. The law is good. That's what Paul says. The law is marvelous. It's good. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 4 real quickly. Deuteronomy chapter 4. I think I give this to you on the sheet, but or on the PowerPoint, but let's look at it. Deuteronomy chapter 4, at the end of his life, and remember the man who wrote the law down? You know, when you think about it, folks, you know, you're doing your Old Testament read it through, right? So you commit yourself, I'm going to get through the Old Testament this year. So you do Genesis, what fun we're having, right? You get to Exodus, and man, you are cooking with gas about halfway through. And then you get to a lot of stuff. You know, but then you get to Leviticus, and you think, what did I sign up for heaven's sake? You know, how much do I need to know about what to do with the fat underneath the tail of that ram? You know what I'm saying? You have this, and the Torah, think about this, the Torah, the law, the five books of Moses, what we call the Pentateuch, Genesis is entirely narrative. Exodus is narrative up to chapter 20. And then you have a lot of law, then a little more narrative, then a lot of law. That law is a description of the temple, but it's all legislation. This is how the temple, then you get to Leviticus. From Leviticus through Numbers 10 is all legislation. It's statute. It's how people are to live in this covenant nation. Then from Numbers 10, we're relieved. To the end of Numbers, you get more story. The wilderness wanderings, you know, we're having a little fun here. You get to Deuteronomy. It's all law. The second, the Deuteronomos, the second law. And there is just a passel of flat-out legislation, and it touches every corner of life. You build a house, according to Deuteronomy, most of the living is done on the roof, and it tells you exactly how the battlement has to be built so people don't fall off that roof. You know, it's just a legislation about what you eat, where you go, what you wear. All of this legislation, much of it has some spiritual application, much of it really doesn't. About half of it is what you and I would call tort law. As I understand it, tort has to do with some sort of grievance between two people who don't have a contractual relationship. So if I trip on your sidewalk and sue you, that's a tort consideration. Am I right? Am I close? And the point is that all through the book of Deuteronomy, if your ox gets loose and tears up your garden, your neighbor's garden, you have to pay for it. All of this stuff. Why? Because this is God instructing His covenant people, His people over whom He is reigning as king, exactly how this culture must behave itself. You know, S.I. Macmillan, anybody know that name? He wrote a book years ago in the 60s called None of These Diseases. Kind of a fascinating little book. Talks about how he makes the point, by the way, in that book that a lot of people wonder why in the ancient world Israel never had doctors. In other words, all that we know about ancient Israel, all the digging we've done and so on, all the archaeology, you go to Egypt, and there are all of these evidences of physicians and some of their machinations and some of their rather remarkable, you know, boring nine holes in some guy's head and eight of them, you know, there's a skull that they discovered that had eight times they had done some sort of brain surgery, and he lived long enough for nine times, and evidently the ninth one got him, but the eight healed up. So evidently they were doing some pretty significant brain surgery back there, you know. But it didn't happen in Israel, and they always think, well, that was because they were so primitive. Baloney, because God said, if you'll obey me, you won't have those diseases. That's exactly why. Now, there are other reasons. There were many of the laws itself. I mean, resting every seventh day, and there are just many of them have remarkable hygienic and salubrious, you know, that word's a good word, means health-giving overtones and so on. But the fact is that, I was going to say, Macmillan says in his book, forgive me if this is indelicate, that one of the greatest plagues, and I said this one time to a guy who had spent his whole life as in armed services, in the army, in the military, in the infantry, training men and so on, and he said that treating human disposal is just the most serious problem in the military and so on. And Macmillan says in the First World War, more soldiers died of dysentery than died of gunshot wound. It was a huge issue and so on. Well, you go to the book of Deuteronomy, and it tells you how to build and use a latrine. And it's very, very clear. And it doesn't usually come up in junior church, if you know what I'm saying. But the fact of the matter is that it's hugely important to, if God's going to be king and his people are going to defend it, they need to know these things. See what I'm saying? So it's just, it touches every area of life. It's just, I have you in Deuteronomy 4. Because Moses says, but he's speaking for God here, and this, remember, by Deuteronomy is Moses is about to die, and he's going to give him this second law which prepares them for life in the land and so on. But he says in Deuteronomy 4 in verse 10, he says, is that what I want? No, 5. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 5. Surely, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as Yahweh my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them. Now watch this. For this is your wisdom and your understanding. What? These statutes. In the sight of all the peoples who will hear all of these statutes, and they will say, see, God is putting himself on display to the rest of the world. And these stories are going to be carried, even this law. And they will say, surely, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. What great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? And what, verse 8, great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all of this law? Now, folks, you can't have a culture, you can't have a society if you don't have a workable system of laws. And there has never been, I could go on and on, you know, almost everything, I already have, but almost everything that we find noble in a system of jurisprudence, that is criminal justice. Now, frankly, I don't want to get started on this, but I think ours is maybe lost. But in terms of what renders a, and you can't have a workable culture if you don't have a equitable and workable system of jurisprudence. There are two grand principles which defined, and this is huge in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you know, you hear about this, you know, for instance, adultery was to be punished by stoning. Well, understand, always, it's explicit in many texts, others it's assumed, but it's clear. That always means that the person accused is taken before a judge. And that judge hears the testimony. So you don't just grab somebody and take them out and stone them. That never happens, never. But you take them before a judge, and now you have a criminal judge. Criminal justice has to take place here. You have to try this case. And there are two principles of jurisprudence that are at the basis of everything noble about a workable system of jurisprudence. The other is, quite simply, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every matter be established. Why? That's a jurisprudential principle. The point is, the only way to convict a person of a crime is eyewitnesses. And you have to have at least two, and there should be, and better if there are three. Why do we have a Fifth Amendment? Why? Where'd that come from? Straight from that principle. You can't force the accused to testify against himself. Those witnesses have to be independent eyewitnesses. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every matter be established. The second principle, and this always fascinates me, because when I say this, almost every one of you is going to say, wait a minute, to me that sounds barbaric. But the second grand principle that insinuates a measure of wisdom and equity and just justice into a system of jurisprudence is what's called lex talionis. Do you know what that is? Pardon? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you say that, and it's always appealed to as some barbaric time when people just went around, you hit me, I hit you back. Folks, there is such wisdom. That principle was always understood to demand, to ramify in two demands. Number one, the punishment must fit the crime. Now, you just can't say, you know, there is an ancient law code called the Code of Hammurabi. You've maybe heard of this. It's from old Babylon. It's been recovered by archaeologists and deciphered, and it's very extensive, and it's very, very contemporary to Moses. So we have an interesting pagan or non-Jewish parallel. In the Code of Hammurabi, if you steal from a commoner, you repay fourfold. If you steal from the king, your hand is lopped off. Now, stealing is stealing. And if, in fact, justice becomes a means of aggrandizing the king or celebrating the importance of the king, it's not justice any longer. That's so big. There are countries, I've read this, I don't know what you do, where when you're stopped for speeding, the police has access to your bank account. That is, he knows how much. And if you are a poor person, you don't pay much. But if you're rich, you can pay thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, if there's anything in there that says, yeah, that's good, God, it's wrong. You're not going to have, you see, the punishment must fit the crime. Or it's not justice. If the justice system becomes a means of social engineering or aggrandizing one group at the expense of the others, it's no longer justice. And the whole culture is going to disintegrate. The second principle, number one, the justice must fit, the punishment must fit the crime. And number two, it's only the perpetrator, or as Beretta used to say, if you do the crime, you do the time. Right? The person who does the crime has to do the time. Now, it's interesting, in that same code that I just mentioned, the Code of Hammurabi, if I build you a house, and you're living in that house, and a beam falls down and kills your daughter, you kill my daughter. See, that's barbaric. She has nothing to do with it. But under the law of Moses, it was only the person. And they always, and it's another interesting thing is, the Jewish people, the most ancient world, they never understood this to demand literally putting the guy's eye out. But they understood it to mean that, number one, the person who did the crime is the one who pays the punishment. Number two, the punishment has to fit the crime. And there's this long discussion in the ancient Jewish literature called the Mishnah about what would happen if we tried to take this literally. And they say, imagine a village where a man accidentally puts another man's tooth out, and he's found, because it says an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and you're found guilty. You were careless, you put that man's tooth out. Or maybe you were mad, you put his tooth out. And so if we decide that literally that we're going to take that, we have to actually put his tooth out, somebody's going to give him that assignment, and maybe as he's trying to knock that tooth out, he knocks two tooth out. So now somebody else has got to knock his tooth out, and he says pretty soon we'd have a whole village full of toothless men. So the point is, they say, we'll come up with a fine, and it'll be well-described and well-defined and so on, but it'll fit the crime. Now, what I'm saying to you is this, and again, remember all the ways in the book of Deuteronomy that, and Leviticus as well, by the way, that the poor were cared for? Remember, you could not go back and re-glean your fields and so on. Just such care. I'll tell you another area that is really remarkable, and this is hard on us. This is hard on us, and I may open a can of worms here that we can talk about in a few minutes in the question. I'm not getting very far, but we'll just do it the way we do it, okay? I'll get through these seven, but maybe not tonight. But remember the law of leveret marriage? You know what that is? Leveret Levirate. This is how it's universally identified. That's not a biblical word. It's not a Levitical word. It's a Latin word, and it means brother-in-law. And the law of levirate marriage said that when a woman was widowed before she had children, the family of her husband had to provide her husband's brothers had to play the husband to her, what the Bible says. And the idea is he had to come to her and raise up children. Now, that sounds difficult to us. And it shows up in the biblical record a number of times and so on. In the ancient world, I'm going to get lost in this if I'm not careful, but you have to understand that in the ancient world they lived as clans. A clan is an extended family, and it's basically the male citizens of the family. In other words, if this clan bears a son, that son is going to grow up, and maybe you'll go to this clan over here and fetch him a wife, and now he will strengthen your clan. And everything is about the size of this clan. You're desperate for your clan to get larger. It gives you security, it gives you prestige and so on. Everything. There is no unit of culture, of society, which has any meaning in the ancient world other than the clan. Now, the point is, and that will explain so many different things about the way life is lived in the ancient world. But go back to that scenario. This clan makes, you know, secures a wife for one of your boys from this clan. Now, she comes over here and joins this clan. Your clan goes on its way. She's now a part of this clan. Her husband dies. She has no children. You see, her husband undoubtedly has brothers. Now, as much as they mourn the loss of their brother, the fact is that their part of their father's estate just grew larger. See the point? They don't have to split it as many ways. And the last thing they want to do is, you see, there's a huge reason for widows to be rejected. And they were. There was nobody in the ancient world that was more thoroughly and certainly destitute than widows. And very few cultures made any provision whatever. We found the law of levirate marriage in a few other ancient cultures. I am fully persuaded they borrowed it from the Hebrews. But it is such a remarkable indication of the care and the concern of that Levitical law system, that law system that God gave, that God provided that, and by the way, not only was the family responsible to raise up seed to that woman, because you see, in your old age, the only provision you had was your children, which is biblical. I'm getting to the age where I remind my children of this quite often. But honest to goodness, I think there is nothing which has more thoroughly cut the nerve of compassion in our family, in our culture, than the notion that the government ought to take care of people when they get old. Children, you know, when the Bible says that a man who does not care for his own household is worse than an infidel, it's not talking about parents taking care of children. It's talking about children taking care of parents. This is exactly what Jesus meant when he talked about how the Pharisees who used the word Corban to excuse caring for their children were in high-handed violation of the commandment that children honor their parents. So I'm telling you, it is so important. And if you're taking care of an aged loved one, God bless you. Be careful about it. It's your sacred responsibility. But I say all that just to make this point, that in most culture, there was no provision made whatever. Look, in so many ways. I mentioned some of the hygienic ways. Macmillan in his book, are you familiar with this? He points out how that up until the early 1900s, in France, the mortality of the rate of women who went to the hospital to bear a child was like about 1 in 2. Are you familiar with this? I mean, it was almost suicide. And so nobody would go to a doctor to have a baby. And there was a doctor, I don't remember his name, he tells this story in some detail, Macmillan does, about how this doctor observed the fact that these attending doctors would go from one woman to the next and never wash their hands. And so he instituted a policy by which he demanded that after they examined one woman, they wash their hands. And there was such a They reacted with so, they were so angry, they had to spend all this time washing their hands that they threw the guy out. He came to America, did something in Baltimore, instituted the same policy. They got so mad at him, they threw him out there. He finally suicided. But finally, when people began to realize that they were spreading disease, and by the way, he insisted that they wash their hands in running water. You go to Leviticus, and it says that after you handle somebody who is unclean, you wash your hands in running water. They almost copied from Leviticus the demands, you know, and all of these things were written into this code in such a way that when other nations heard about it, they would say, my, what people is there who has a law so wise and so equitable as this law? Does that make sense to you? That what God gave the children of Israel in this law system, which, look, it included, bless God, a means by which your sin could be covered. The whole Levitical system of sacrifices, which was so, but that's not all there is. It's important, but it's not all that there is. And it was a comprehensive system of statutes and laws and regulations and restrictions and punishments that if instituted, when instituted, and there were seasons when it was instituted, and if instituted, it would render the culture so blessed and so fruitful and so equitable that other nations would be jealous of it. Does that make sense to you? Now, what's that got to do with anything? Let's put it in what I'm talking about. God's intent was that Israel would be a witness. In order to make that happen, he shaped the earth in such a way that all the nations of the earth are going to make a way through that little land. But he shaped the land in such a way that they could live in the mountains in the central hook country out of themselves and honor God no matter what was going on in the rest of the world. And then he gave them this law system, which to that they the degree that they honored it, the rest of the nation would say, what people is there that hath a God so nigh or a law so perfect as these people? See the point? And that's why I go back to it. That's why I say, irrespective of the salvation of this person or that, when the people lived as God intended, they were going to be a blinding light witness to the rest of the nations. All right, let me give you one more, and then we'll finish it tomorrow night and do some other things as well. But the fifth one, is what I call, and in terms of alliteration, I think this is an absolute tour de force, but what do you care? But regular rainfall, rapid runoff, and God's requirement of righteousness. I can say this quickly. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 10. With this, we'll be done. Deuteronomy chapter 10. And you know what? Hold on, maybe 11. Deuteronomy 11. And I talked before about the central hill country, about the hills of Israel and so on, and that water. See, water is a huge, in the ancient world especially, but even today, Israel is so perplexed over their water situation, and they when you think of Israel, whisper a prayer in terms of that God would supply them with water. It's such a desperate situation today. But the fact is, like I say, Israel gets plenty of water. But the land is so steep, and the water comes in buckets. You know, the average rainfall, the average annual rainfall in Jerusalem is higher than that of London. Would you have thought that? But they get plenty of water. They get upwards of 25, 26 inches of water. But it runs off so quickly. Now, by the way, time out. The problem that they have today is that the water system that's so dependent upon the Sea of Galilee has been so drained, and the Sea of Galilee is falling to hitherto they've never had it as low as it is. I mean, they used to worry about the red line. They have now defined a black line. And they're afraid that the Sea of Galilee may cease to function as a lake if it gets below where it's getting close to now. But anyway, go way back, Deuteronomy 11, verse 10. God says this. He says, for the land which you... Now, by the way, this is a passage in which Moses is warning the Israelites that God demands obedience and knows how to punish disobedience and has built the land in such a way that they will certainly... He has a short leash, which he can give a good yank anytime he wants. And here it is. Deuteronomy 10, verse 11. The land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys which drinks water from the rain of heaven. Now, that's exactly what I was talking about. They get this rain, but it runs off so quickly, it's so hard to catch. And the point is that you cannot depend upon last year's supply. You need a new supply each year. As he says in verse 12, go to verse 10. That's right. I started in verse 11. That's what I want you to see. The land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot. Now, the point is, you could put a garden anywhere because you could go with a pail and fetch a bucket of water and water the garden. So you're used to this land which never wanted water. You say, wait a minute, there were famines in Egypt too. You know what? The famines in Egypt were almost always a function of too much water. When the water didn't recede so they could have that soil where they could plant. But they always had plenty of water. They got the Nile River, you know. I pick it up again in verse 11, but the land which you go over to possess is a land of hills and valley which drinks water from the rain of heaven. A land for which, now watch this, the Lord your God cares. Now watch this, the eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. What he means by that is this land will prosper and you will be able to grow grain only if the Lord watches over it year by year. Because he goes on to say, look at verse 13, he says, it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments which I command you today to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart and soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain. In the old King James, it's the former rain and the latter rain. Now, let me explain what this is all about. In Israel, there are two very distinct seasons. I think I give you some of this on your sheet. But here. On the one hand, you have what's called the winter rainy season. And this is from basically September, October through March, April. And during that season, I'll just tell you this way. For 6 months, all the weather comes off the Mediterranean Sea. And then you have a huge transition season, and for the next 6 months, the summer season, it all comes off the Arabian Desert. Now, in the winter, you're looking for regular rain. In the winter, you grow the grain. In the summer, on the other hand, the summer dry season, there is no rain. And not very little, not much rain. It doesn't rain in the summer. In the summer, early in the summer, you finish the grain harvest, and then you work on the hillside crops. So you have these two seasons, the winter rainy season and the summer dry season. Do you recall the passage or the story in 1 Samuel chapter 12? Where Samuel has made Saul king and he's turning the reins over to him, but he's making the point that the theocracy is still in place and God's still going to bless your obedience and curse your disobedience. And then Samuel says this, to prove that I'm speaking for God, is it not wheat harvest? To prove that I'm speaking for God, I will call upon God to send thunder and rain. Wheat harvest comes in the summer, early in the summer. You never harvest your wheat until you're past the rainy season. So in the summer, it doesn't rain. And the Bible goes on to say, so Samuel called upon the Lord, and he sent thunder and rain, and all Israel believed Yahweh and his prophet Samuel. That was a true blue, no kidding around miracle. When rain, and I think it probably fell from a blue sky. But the point is, it's a miracle for rain to fall in the summer season. That make sense to you? So I can come back to it. You have the winter season, and then you have the summer season. Now, here's the big thing. During the summer, and understand, I'm going to say more about this tomorrow night, but during the summer, you grow the hillside crops. All right, time out. Even in the summer, and the hillside crops I talked about before are primarily grapes and figs and pomegranates and olives. Grapes, figs, pomegranates, and olives. And even though there's no rain, in the summer, about 80% of the hill country reaches dew point about two nights in three. So you get a heavy dew. And those summer crops will grow on the dew. Does that make sense to you? See, what happens is during the summer, the sun beats and it gets very warm. The sun is up. I mean, it's hot early and it's hot all day long. But because Israel lies between the desert and the sea, and all the weather is coming off the Arabian Desert, but during the day, the sun beats, and toward the end of the day, about middle afternoon, that air gets heated and it begins to rise, and you get the displacement off the Mediterranean Sea. You live for that. You survive in the summer on those afternoon breezes. They are luscious. I was there last July. It was as hot, literally, as it's ever been. Since they started keeping records in 1940, it was 113 degrees when we were at the Dead Sea. But we were up there in Jerusalem, and about 3 o'clock, and we would get together and have dinner in our hotel, and it was out in the patio. We'd move out in the patio every night, and by about 6 o'clock, it was still the sun was still shining. I mean, it was low on the horizon, but the women would start to take the tablecloths and wrap them around them because they were chilled because of those beautiful breezes that come off. Now, those are moist breezes, and so when the sun goes down, the dew settles, and the summer crops grow by the dew. Got that? So in the winter, you grow the grain crops. In the summer, you grow the hillside crops. The grain, you desperately need rain. And it's a short growing season. But here's my point. All through the summer, the sun bakes the earth, and it gets so hard, you can't even get a plow. I mean, they don't have a lot of tillable soil, but they nurture and husband that tillable soil. But you can't even get a plow in the ground until what is called the former rains, because this is what happens. And I'm going to tell you, if you can explain this better, why I'd appreciate it. But as I understand, I mean, I know this happens. I've been there to witness, I've experienced it. But what happens is, during the summer, all the weather's coming off the Arabian. It's hot. You get this hot sun baking the earth and so on. But then you have what's called the sirocco, and it's a huge transition season. And that transition season, during that time, you get a dumping of rain. For 2 weeks, it almost every day. I was there just once, and it was such a serendipitous thing because I was there. It was October. I was teaching at a campus there in Israel. The kids had been there since late August. They were tired of the heat. They were anxious for the winter season to come. You know, they were really weary of it. And we were walking. A good buddy of mine. We were walking across the moshav, and all of a sudden he stopped me. He said, "Bookman, you feel that?" And I said, "That's a nice breeze." And he says, "No, it's more than a breeze. That's long after the displacement, that's a breeze off the Mediterranean." And he said, "Tomorrow we'll get rain." I got up in the morning, it was raining, and it rained for 6 days. And that's the former rains. And you need the former rain to break up the ground and to moisten the earth so you can get they have a very short season, growing season. Then all through the winter, you're praying for rain. But when the summer season comes, just before you have that same effect, you get a dumping of rain. You desperately need that grain to set the kernel on the grain and so on, and to mature it. And so you're not going to have grain if you don't have the former and the latter rains. See the point? And God says, if you obey, now think about it, folks. This is a culture in which you literally live from harvest to harvest. If you don't get rain, you won't have grain. If you don't get grain, you don't have bread, and you don't have feed for your animals, and therefore you don't have milk for your children. It is terribly serious that you have rain, and only God can give you the rain. And so he says, the land you're going to is not the land you left, where you didn't have to worry year by year. You're going to a land where you are going to be absent. The Lord has to care for this land year by year. If you obey, I'll send you the rain in its season, the former and the later rain. But if you don't, I'll withhold it. And so now comes the beginning of summer, and you've brought in the grain. I've watched them harvest grain that high. I mean to tell you, whatever there is, whatever kernel there is, they'll go out and pull it in. Now, Israel has never been able, especially in the modern world, to survive on her own grain. She has depended upon her neighbors. It's usually been Egypt throughout much of history where they had to go to get the grain. But my point is, it's a means by which God... So, we're done. But let me bring as far as I bring it. What I'm trying to say is, understand what's going on in the Old Testament. It's not like what we know today in many ways. Number one, God raised up Israel with the intent that they would be salt and light. Number two, in order for that to be possible, in order for that to happen, he crafted the world in such a way that all the nations of the world, the caravans of the world, are going to be making their way through that little land. They're going to hear the stories. They're going to carry. to the uttermost parts of the world is going to hear about this Yahweh God. And it did. But on the other hand, he shaped the earth and the land in such a way that Israel could live in the hill country and be a nation set apart, a set apart people, in order that they might live under Yahweh no matter what was going on in the broader world. And then he gave them this remarkable law system, which to the degree they would honor it, would distinguish Israel among all the nations of the world. They'd be amazed at what a good God they had, what a just system of law. And then because he knew that they, like we, were prone to disobedience, he crafted the climate in such a way that they were absolutely dependent year by year on the former and latter rain. And he promised them, if you disobey, I'll withhold that rain. He had a short leash that he could yank very easily. That make sense to you? All right, there are two more. We'll talk about those tomorrow night and then keep going. The one I really enjoy is the next one, and I meant to get to it tonight, but we'll just do it tomorrow night. Pastor mentioned, I know I may have excited a lot of questions. I know also that life is hugely busy and that you got a lot of things to do, and most of you can't sleep in the morning like I can if I wish to, but I don't know that I will. But my point is, God bless you. We're going to have a word of prayer and be done. If you'd like to, in about 5 or 6 minutes, we'll just assemble down here. And if you got questions, I'd love to spend 15 or 20 minutes, you know, if honestly, whatever questions I might have excited, I think that might be a good way to do it. Okay? Let me have a word of prayer with you. Father, again, we thank you for your word, and we thank you for this blessed reality that you have been so careful in every age and every way to make yourself known to men, to set yourself before an unbelieving world in order to draw them to yourself. God, you have proven yourself such a good and careful and wise God. And Father, I just thank you for the testimony that you have made Israel to be, even in disobedience. She is a testimony to who you are as God, to your justice and your care and your covenant faithfulness. And so, Father, we rejoice over this portion of Scripture that is a bit foreign to us, but is so precious. And I'd ask again that it might be the more real and the more compelling because of the time we have. Thank you for these folk. I'd pray that in your providences, as is possible, you'd bring them together again tomorrow evening. But Father, in all things, equip us to honor you, and we'll thank you in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, I think we can be dismissed, right? Tom, have I left anything out? All right, God bless you. Thanks so much.